Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Panel, Out with the Old, In with the New, How Savvy IVD Marketers Are Converting Millennial Lab Buyers into Customers. The presenters are Bruce Carlson, Market Research Consultant, Eye on IVD Newsletter, Fort Lee, New Jersey, Deb Hewitt-Smith, Principal, Talking Labs, Tucson, Arizona, Bob McGonigal, Publisher, CAP Today, College of American Pathologists, Northfield, Illinois, and Lynn Raplagel, Senior Director, Commercial Strategy and Market Access, Veranex, Brooklyn.
If that's okay. I think people are still coming in, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discussion, so we're going to go ahead and get started. So welcome everyone to Out with the Old, In with the New, and How Savvy IVD Marketers Are Converting Millennial Lab Buyers into Customers. I'm Deb Hewitt-Smith, and for those of you I have not met, I've spent my whole career in marketing, product management, marketing communications, partner relations. I spent half my career on the software side of lab, and I've spent the other half on the IVD side, and I don't know if they're here yet, but folks are here from both of those companies, Sysmex and Clinisys, so I'm kind of excited today. Anyway, I'm joined by three industry experts who bring different insights into the market trends through their research and activities. We've planned an interactive session. I hope that's going to work for everyone. Usually the marketing sessions I've done in the past, there is a lot of good interaction. So please feel free to put your questions in the app as you think about it, but sir, we won't prevent you from bringing up other things as well as your own insights that you want to share. So first, before we start, maybe a show of hands to kind of get a feel for who's in the audience. How many of you come from the healthcare provider or lab side? Oh, wow. A large number. Yeah, there we go. And on the supplier side? Okay, great. Excellent. And how many of you are responsible or have line responsibility for marketing and or sales? Okay, good. Yay, great. Welcome. Okay, super. So with that, I would like to have you meet the panel today. And we're going to start with Bruce, and they're going to introduce themselves and maybe give you a few opening remarks, and then we'll go right into some discussion and questions.
Okay, thanks, Deb, and thanks, everyone, for being here. I'm Bruce Carlson. As Deb said, I was formerly with Calorama Information Market Research. Now I have my own newsletter on LinkedIn, Eye on IVD, cover IVD markets. I will be releasing market research reports of my own shortly. I find it a little bit choppy out there in the IVD market, a challenging time. I find, with some silver lining and some interesting scrappy companies making some interesting moves, but growth for the overall IVD market to low single digits. So a lot of challenges. My concrete message would be all of the challenges that you hear about at this meeting for laboratories are in some degree mirrored, right, in those that supply equipment to laboratories. So when we talk about whether it's LTDs or payer issues in particular, that's down the line going to affect IVD market. So these are all concerns, along with additional concerns. Like, I'll talk about it a bit later if it comes up, but there's going to be discussion here, or there was, about the trifecta of issues affecting labs. I think we're IVD, it's at least a quadfecta. So I think that, so there's a lot of challenges, some silver linings, some hopes, some moves that players are making. And we'll get into it. It's going to be a little interactive, so we'll look forward to your questions as well.
Thank you, Bruce. Make sure this is working. Speak loudly. Lynn Raplagel from Veranex. Focus in commercial strategy and precision medicine, also market access, and I know that the focus here is on millennials, but I think really what trends we're seeing in the market is that everyone is going online. build trust with companies they're looking at. So laboratories are not excluded from that. So I think increasingly that's becoming the norm, just not just something millennials do. And also I think you're seeing where digital marketing can really augment the sales process. And traditionally labs, the process has been to sell, it's that one-to-one connection, and there's not this online presence and information about the lab, what the lab offers. There's not a social media presence. So I was actually talking to Deb earlier about this before the panel, and I was asking, why are there not more digital marketing laboratory providers at the conference? But I haven't seen one sponsor any events. So I think this is something that we will see increasingly in the future, and so that's excited to talk more about.
Hello, I'm Bob McGonigal. I'm the publisher of the CAP Today, a longtime employee of the College of American Pathologists. And my perspective really comes from a saying I learned years and years ago from a very good friend of mine, Bob DeCrease, who's a pathologist in Chicago. And his line that I've never forgotten, quoted many, many times in 40 years, "When the hospital catches cold, the lab gets pneumonia." And nobody can be a successful IVD marketer if the lab itself really doesn't have the funds or the willingness or the need and desire to buy new gear. And LDTs, of course, have taken a lot of the air out of the environment, the oxygen out of the room. How soon that breaks up again and we get back to normal is anybody's guess. But we know consolidation plays an enormous part in the marketing that any IVD company has to do. You look at people in systems, they want to have one box from one company that will fit in a small lab, medium-sized lab, a core lab, and then be able to be hooked up to the appropriate automation in an enormous core factory. There's not many players that still qualify to do that, so it's a lot easier to know who you need to evaluate rather than go through 3 dozen or so companies the way it might have been 25 years ago. So I'm very happy to also understand that labs are continuing to have to commit enormous sums of money to solving their staffing shortages and to cybersecurity and other IT needs that are very immediate and very important. So IVD marketers have never had an easy time of it, but right now I think it's about as difficult as it has been. And we've certainly seen lots of turnover in the IVD companies themselves. Many, large companies have completely turned over. So it's a perfect storm, but that's also some of the very best times to try to market and sell anything when the expectations are low.
That's right. That's exactly right. How about the room? Any immediate questions? That anything on your mind? I'm sure marketers always have something on their mind they want to talk about. Okay. Nobody has anything on their minds. Go ahead, Bruce.
I'll just jump in on some of Bob's points because he, as always, reminded me of things that I think are very important and should say. Then also on Lynn's point about marketing to millennials, ostensibly one of the, in addition to the challenges and the kind of effect that if you look at the I guess if Robert has the trifecta that's affecting labs, you have the LTD, which is a plus and minus for IVD, by the way. I think that it's, although that there are some IVD companies that celebrate a world like that with certain programs, if you're at, say, Thermo or Diasorin, Luminex, or whatever part of your business is around that, different things. It looks like that we may have dodged the bullet with that final, at least with the final rule. I'm still skeptical about what the FDA is going to do once it's established the control that it's established. But we'll put that aside. So a bunch of challenges. The main challenge being the same as the laboratories have. If there are problems with claims, if there are struggles with denials,
how long before that catches up into the IVD markets. It simply means that at some point there's less reagents being sold. That new instrument that you're trying to place is going to be more difficult because the first question is, how do I get paid on this? My payer's, you know, putting their backup on this. So there was a talk this morning with Ziffin, and where the stat that I heard was of their customers, which is pretty representative, I would say, molecular tests, 11% of the revenue that their customers get from molecular tests has to be fought for, has to go through at least one appeal, and sometimes two or three to get it. That's 11%, and it's up from 7% in 2021. It's not that long ago, and presumably that's the trend. That's an issue for IVD because what's the fastest growth market of IVD that companies are banking on is molecular testing. There's a couple other areas too that have the few areas that have high growth rates, right? That you might be some continuous glucose testing or certain immunoassays or some point of care. But molecular is where all the hopes are pinned on. So if there's trouble with reimbursement, that's going to come down the line. That's at least three issues that labs have in their trifecta, and then I have a quadfecta, which is, it looks like the FDA is coming down a little harder on research-only testing, which, although it's not strictly IVD, is, of course, part of many IVD companies. When we say IVD companies, that doesn't mean everything they're selling is IVD. So that's part of many companies' strategy and part of the most innovative companies' strategy. So if there was always a little bit of a wink-wink, nod-nod about selling tests which could be used for a clinical purpose. If we're going to start really enforcing that, that'll be an issue. There's a lot of issues facing on vitro diagnostics. Adding to that is this generations are changing, and new buyers, I saw a statistic that 40% of purchasers, and this is a more broad statistics, are of a millennial generation. These generational titles I have a little issue with. You can split it up, Zennials. I'm a Gen Xer. Not only do I feel like we never got our due, but I also feel like, you know, we're split. Half of us are baby boom leaning. Half of us are millennial leaning anyway. I don't use my phone that much. My wife's always on the phone. I brought a Trapper Keeper notebook to this meeting. That's my laptop. Put that aside. So, but to the extent overall these generations do work in a larger sense of, hey, look who's coming down the pike, it's yet another challenge that in vitro diagnostic companies will need to put in the mix. We know, I don't think any of the statistics will surprise the millennials a little bit more. Desire to see a video, for instance, not as much into company literature as an online forum that's independent, not even as into social media, which might seem obvious, but if it's company social media, I saw some limited stats that I had where not as likely to buy into that. They'd rather see an independent social media. Those are things, in addition to all the challenges IVD companies have, it's one more set of issues that they'll have to address. It's very difficult with regulatory restraints, like every video has to be approved. So, and yet, you know, your buyers want more video. So these are all challenges that I think will be part of the next 5 years. We'll see how it shakes out.
Lynn, do you want to talk to trends that you're seeing?
Sure. Yeah, I think one thing that I deal with pretty frequently is both pharma and diagnostic clients. So I work with a lot of companion diagnostic tests. And with a lab that is trying to promote a companion diagnostic test, there's just a lot more stakeholders than what you might have with a non-companion. So you've got patient groups, you've got physicians, you've got potential other lab partners, payers, regulatory bodies, and it's not just in the U.S., it's global. So you've got to figure out what is my marketing strategy for each one of those? It's a combination of in-person and online, and then how do I tailor this globally? I mean, that is not an easy task, and it takes a lot of inputs to develop that plan. So I think that's one thing that I'm seeing. It's just increasingly more complex to be able to actually run a CDX business, and it's funneling up to the companies that are able to financially support that and have the experience to do it. So that's kind of one of the things I've seen recently.
Do you want to add to that, Bob?
Yeah, I think one of the remarks that's worth making is how hard the job of marketing and sales is today. In part, we have such consolidation, as I've already mentioned. But as you know, we have many, many labs that have contracts that are running 5, 6, 7, and 8 years where the lab is contracted with a vendor. And those are going to be very hard to break. They can be broken, but they're hard to break. And people really are quite interested in the laboratories and the sort of the long-term reputation and steadiness of their supplier. They worry about people leaving the market. They worry about sales of companies to one another, of which we've seen an awful lot of. And it seems to me that almost everyone now needs to have a presence online without being caught trying to sell or advertise. So we run with the Kantar Group, which is a very large market research company in medical. They ask a pretty standard question across many of the lines. What's the importance of sources of information for you about products and services? I'll read the top five that come up all the time. Professional publications in print, professional publications in online, newsletters and printed email, professional associations, and websites. The reason is people want to go to a trusted partner where they feel like the information is very objective, it's been carefully edited, it's been carefully vetted. I mean, I'm an employee of the College of American Pathologists, so at the CAP today, we take very seriously our editorial responsibility to be clear, to be rather independent. We're not going to distort things in the market. Certainly, we're not going to do that deliberately. So I think that's important. And furthermore, I think the marketing mix today is requiring you to do more, and that's a terrible burden to put on you. But there is just so much. I open up my computer every morning and have to delete 79 emails from people. So how are you going to get a message through if you're not playing that same game and not playing it with some creativity and some attention and getting people to open your messages? And even in print advertising, right now we run an enormous digital marketing group and a digital advertising group at CAP today. It will soon, print will probably be about half of our revenue within 2 years. It continues to climb up. And people are consuming our media both in print and online in some different ways. And most of the people are using both. So you have to be able to have these messages where you get them. I often say it's really, if you're going to advertise with us, whether it's digital or in print, if you're only going to do it twice a year, in some ways you should save your money, because that's not nearly the kind of frequency of message that you need to get in order to get a real hit to the head of a consumer, no matter how old or young they are, it seems to me.
Is that approved by your advertising department?
Well, I'm the one-man advertising department.
Yeah. Okay.
That carries our approval. But it's just very difficult. I mean, you all know if you turn on your television, I'm always appalled at just how many advertisements there are in a football game or any other kind of television. It's amazing compared to what it was 20 years ago. It seems like it was easy and quiet and very nice. But what are your experiences with the marketing? I'm interested, what are your reactions to, you all go to trade shows, I know. And if there's a phenomenon post-COVID, the companies are very happy to be there, but you don't see the attendance from the end user customer that you used to see in some ways. What's your experience?
My experience is we're busier.
You're busier now.
So the total attendance is down,
right?
But the engagement is higher.
Okay, that's reasonable.
But what my question is the way organizations purchase is changing. Mm-hmm. It has evolved a lot over the last 5-10 years, where it used to be the lab manager, the technical director, the medical director would make a decision. Now it's a buying committee. Procurement has an input. It's, mm-hmm. it's an IDN-wide decision. It's procurement, it's quality, it's mm-hmm. administration. These people don't read laboratory professional publications.
Understood.
For the most part. Mm-hmm. And so how do you see, where do these people go? Where do you find these people? That's our struggle, right? You know, how do we get the message out to these segments, which not necessarily are the customer that's going to say, yes, I want to buy this, but they can have significant veto power.
Sure, sure. But with what company are you, sir? It helps me to...
Grifols.
With Grifols, okay. And what part of Grifols? I know them as a blood banking behemoth. That's it, okay. I would say selling and buying is a more complex process than it ever has been before. You probably all would agree with that. You've got more people to see. You have more pockets of veto power, as you put it. But I think I'd like to talk about two levels of selling. One is there's a brand preference that's going to tend to come from the typical people that you've mentioned before, the laboratory director, the lab administrator, mm-hmm. management, section supervisor. That's one sale, the choice of brand. The second sale is up in administrative suites where the contract has got to get approved, and it's often held up there. And I know some companies now that are working with two different teams. So they have a marketing and sales team that works at the laboratory level, gets the preference, and then they turn this over to a better corporate sales group, which is at home in the C-suite, to land the contract, not to change the brands. And I think that makes it much more complex, and as we all know, it's a very, very lengthy process.
On the institutional sale, I mean, the basic rule of institutional sales is the more people your sales rep talks to, and I don't have to tell you, this is in books, there's whole books about institutional sales, but you do get that occasional sales rep that's like, I got the guy, and it's not going to work in any business, in our publications business or in your in vitro diagnostics business. It does not negate the other side of marketing. So you still have to reach all the users, because if there's no user lobby, you'll never get that business. So there's still, so it really sets up, like Bob said, two different marketing areas. And one is almost not really selling. It's almost a mitigating of cost reduction. By the way, it happens in publications too.
Oh, yes,
any almost any business, there's a purchasing department that we get, I get a bonus if I cut your contract by 10% for no reason at all. It happens in almost any, happens in market research, happens in anything. Mm-hmm. And I think, so there's still a user lobby. You gotta think about, and that's where there, I think in that group is where, say, the millennial cohort, if we're even to talk about that, or the Zennials, or, lesser, you know, one side of Gen X, whatever, whoever are these people that are now taking more of these decision roles, maybe, rather than the contract, and thinking about advertising. And I do notice that, you know, with some of the advertising that you see, there seems to be like, oh, we'll put a QR code in there. And it's like off to the side. And then you go and it's the company website. I think about, and this doesn't answer the contract. It definitely doesn't answer the C-suite side of the question, but still in that important other side of marketing, think about new ways, videos, gamification, information that you can actually show a display of the booth for the convention that they're probably not going to anymore. All of these are good use of a QR code than this kind of like, oh, it's over here if you want it, like the, because we had to do it because millennials or something like this, you know, that might occur in the mind. I think that BioMérieux has a really good example of an app. Now, it is for their sales professionals, but it kind of shows you them doing a little bit of this where it's kind of a game. It's if you answer so many questions, you get a score, and it's teaching the sales reps how to sell BioMérieux. It's called Smart BioMérieux, and it's a very useful program that kind of addresses this cohort. And you know, and I guess most of the systems on the user level, most of the systems have your MyCOBIS or MyStarLibs or things like this where people can manage information on your phone. So they're all sort of getting there. But, and I guess the other answer to the question from a market research, from what I could say, is that very setup drives consolidation. There's just no matter. That's the ugly truth of it. In other words, if we're just selling to the C-suite, who sells to the C-suite? Already, the IVD market, over 80% is a dozen to 15 companies.
And easily.
There is still, and I do plan a report on the middle market, because there's still a decent market of many billions that people would die for in other areas of the rest of IVD, right? That isn't the Grifols and the BioMérieux and the Siemens and the Roche and the Abbott's and all. There's still a decent amount there, but it's just continual consolidation is the rule, and these are the reasons why. Who can maintain that waiting for the C-suite but somebody who has the pockets to do it? And it'll just continue. We thought with COVID, for instance, oh, with COVID, there's going to be so many new test companies because so many innovators, because you could start a test company, sell PCR. And you have companies like Q Health that are interesting, but now they're struggling. So they're getting bought up. So that didn't really change. In fact, the research at Kalorama while I was there showed that actually consolidation increased during COVID. So that wasn't even a game changer that anyone thought. But they definitely the well, I don't have an answer to what the solution to that question is. The trend, I'm a good market researcher. I don't solve anything. I just tell you what it is. The trend there definitely drives consolidation.
Lynn, anything to?
Yeah, I was actually going to ask a show of raise of hands of the IVD marketers, whether lab or diagnostic manufacturer. Which of you are actually running any digital paid ads currently? Is anyone current? Okay, a couple hands, yeah. So, I mean, for those of you, I guess, was that a struggle to actually get funding for within your companies, or is this like a, you know, something that's very much at the strategic core of what you want to be doing and kind of getting more business in?
Core.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we're a startup, 120 headcount, but we're a digital pathology AI and workflow software company. The importance of the professional publications is number one, and getting that in front of the right folks digitally, when they are searching automated microscopy or things like that, that's a core part of knowing how to face the staffing shortage. And they're going to start searching for these things. We
want to
be top.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you brought up a lot of creative things that you can do that are kind of more, I would say, advanced digital marketing. I think in this industry, people tend to think, they don't think about Facebook ads or Instagram ads, even any kind of paid advertising on social media, but that's where these people are going already. So it's not like we need to get to, like, creative necessarily. We can just go where they already are and advertise there to send them to the publications.
We see some of that. We do see a lot of companies that have tried to use social media in some ways as a substitute, in my opinion, for marketing products and speaking to customers. I tend to find when I analyze those, because I've done some of this myself as a test, the people who respond to that tend to be inside the company. BD was doing that, a lot of that a couple of years ago. And I finally said to Dave Hickey, who's just retired, I said, Dave, these are wonderful messages on LinkedIn, but do you know that 90% of the people who are liking it or getting impressions work for you? So you're kind of speaking to yourself. It's a, you know, it's a difficult and new, business, you know. Print advertising has been around, not to sound old, but I guess I am. It's been around since about 1650 in the coffee houses of London and the rum shops of, Copenhagen and, Amsterdam and everywhere else. I mention that only because we know a lot about print advertising. It's been highly measured, highly understood, studied scientifically now, since the late 19th century. And, with digital, it's kind of the Wild West. There was a time last year when digital advertising fell off enormously across every B2B market, because what they had found was it wasn't working very well. We had to take our entire digital offering offline and rebuild it on the fly so that we could get rid of the bots. Because any digital ad that we posted was attacked by 900,000 or so bots as soon as it appeared. Within 3 seconds. This is all automated now, okay? So we had, these are enormous challenges now and enormous challenges to learn how to solve. And as far as I'm concerned, it's early innings yet. Very early innings yet. Yes, ma'am.
I find that, trying to get the correct message through the correct media in front of the correct people is the most challenging for IUP marketing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what do you put in CAP today versus what do you put on LinkedIn versus what do you put on YouTube, things like that. It took us a while to kind of build that up too, and you know, you kind of dip your toe in the water for a few years, you know, and try to collect some data. Is it worth doing? I think now what we're struggling with is not just getting the advertising or the links to the web or the web pages and things like that, but also getting the correct mix of messaging for brand awareness, to establish brand loyalty. You put education in front of, you know, whatever audience. Do you put, you know, your flat-out product marketing? You know, what is the correct mix? And I think that's different for the different generations in the laboratory. Could you speak to that a little bit?
You're the expert.
I mean, I guess what segment have you seen that the most acute, where it's different generations respond differently?
Well, I guess, you know, obviously the easiest way to get any metrics from the effectiveness is, of your advertising or your marketing is going to be through social media, right? So we can get some pretty immediate feedback, you know, on that. But it's difficult to know if we're hitting the right people. You know, we can do our boosted marketing, you know, do boosted posts to make sure it's getting to these, you know, whatever specific groups. I think it's just difficult to know how effective it is. This is such a huge buying cycle. It's not like I'm trying to sell the newest pair of shoes.
You're exactly right.
Oh, I need them now. And they go on your website and buy.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of difficult to gauge the effectiveness of your social media marketing.
It has always been well nigh impossible to gauge the effectiveness of advertising. John Wanamaker was a very rich man in Philadelphia. He had Wanamaker's, very famous retail store in Philadelphia. His famous saying was, half of all my advertising dollars are wasted, and I could save a lot of money, but I can't tell which half has been wasted. So I have to do the whole thing, you see? It's very difficult. I know in digital, I think you want to be able to test things that we have a very popular thing called an e-direct. Okay. We can tell you how many thousand we're sending out, and then I'll show you a deployment report about how many actually were delivered. Okay. How many people opened and then how many people clicked. And the clicking is much, much lower than the opens. But for me, the important thing is the delivery, because so many people are not even getting email anymore. I find that in companies, people say, well, we haven't opened my email in a long, long time. Okay. I'm only in some kind of app that's internal to the system of our company. But you're asking an excellent question, but I think it just needs more thought, more people. It takes a lot of time to be a really good, effective marketer.
One thing that we've had pretty good success with, we're primarily on the clinical diagnostic side.
Sure.
We're beginning to dip our toe in the IVD market. We have a CE marked device available outside of the U.S., so I'm speaking more from the clinical diagnostic laboratory side. Search engine optimization has been huge for us.
Sure, sure. Understood.
Outside of just our social media presence, mm-hmm. I have a hard time believing that clinicians are sitting and looking at my Facebook ads. So we've really tried to build upon exactly what everyone in the room has said, is that peer-reviewed publications is the gold standard
right.
for
right.
us, and then building quality content around those publications and being seen by Google as the mm-hmm. expert in the field. So we filter higher than a lot of our national reference laboratory competitors mm-hmm. when there's people are using search terms specific to mm-hmm. our testing. So take with that what you will, but we've invested a lot of money and resources into search engine optimization, as well as with using advanced email analytics and mm-hmm. automated email marketing. So since we're in New Orleans, I kind of consider our marketing mix is like gumbo. I don't know exactly which slice.
That's a good way to put it.
But it's kind of the collective effort that we're working with that has benefited us.
That's very helpful. You do know that Google Analytics is kind of a crude tool. So I don't recommend. It's changing all the time, and Google keeps promising to stop trying to capture cookies. But they're addicted to all those billions of dollars they're earning, so they keep putting it off that, even though privacy laws are starting to catch up with them.
When Robert is a big SEO fan. Who else is doing SEO? And can you talk about it? Can you say what you're doing, how it's effective?
Sure. Yeah. So, well, one thing that speaks to what you were talking about as far as effectiveness and how do we know if a particular channel or a particular message is effective is we work, all of our marketing is organized into campaigns, and the campaigns each have stages, and each stage has a desired action. So I would know if a social post or an SEO page was successful if it has the prospect taking the desired action. Mm-hmm. So we develop core SEO pages that are meant to gain traffic. And then on those pages, there's a funnel with a landing page. So if somebody lands on the page where the desired action is traffic, then the desired action on that page is to submit a form or let us know you're interested in whatever particular solution as part of that campaign. So it's SEO is just one part
of course.
The larger mix of our organic traffic we're really happy with and is supported by our SEO efforts, and we work with a third-party consultant who does all our SEO stuff because mm-hmm. we can do a resource standpoint. I don't have anybody on my team that has the knowledge that mm-hmm. our consultant does and mm-hmm. could
Bingo.
Get an SEO tool
right.
and teach somebody.
Right.
Yeah, sure, but then anyway, I love my SEO consultant.
Oh, you need them because you have to keep up with it. What worked for Google?
No, exactly. Like,
yeah. You have to keep up.
Yeah.
I mean, social media to me, of course it's designed to be forwarded, shared. That's the whole purpose of it. So it's always thinking about something that is that. A picture of the instrument, okay, need we say, isn't gonna work that well unless there's some clear benefit statement, but also perhaps addresses an issue or change, something that would be more compelling than the instrument itself. Very small space in laboratories or a new disease or compelling untreated disease situation, something that might be shared, is obviously what social media is there for. And I don't want to go too far in the interest of time, but in just something that I feel needs to be said with everything going on at this meeting, from the laboratory side, and as I said, I do believe this spills over into the IBD side and all the tension with payers. And it isn't addressed at the individual marketer level in most cases, but you might have a say in it at the table, is that at some point the companies, or through the ADLM or your associations, that part of marketing, addressing testing itself and the need for testing, there absolutely has to be more of a megaphone and a soundbox, or else we'll all just keep getting beat up by payers and governments that want to restrain funding or see lab-developed tests perhaps as something that's just going to lead to more expensive care for people, which I still believe is a little bit of the inside goal of some of the increasing regulation. You see it in some of the statements. Like there have been tests released that have led to more procedures, increasing costs for governments. Well, so advocacy groups in the marketing, they do about testing itself to the consumer and educating the consumers, and then by virtue of that, politicians, state governments, federal government is probably the most important thing that can happen long term for both the laboratory industry and the IBD industry.
And I think we haven't really talked a lot about payers and whether it's government or commercial payers. I think that honestly is one area where it's still a one-to-one kind of sale, if you will. There are a lot of marketing materials that go into it. It's generating the evidence. It's putting that together in a value deck or value dossier. But ultimately, I don't think payer decisions are being made on what a payer and ads that they're seeing on social media or LinkedIn.
Oh no.
However, your state representative might be behind the scenes about to pass a law, that would affect that.
I think they do look at kind of the company presence, whether or not they have a social media account and they have a website and they look somewhat credible. They can easily access the evidence. So there is that part of it, but I think definitely a stakeholder where it's still pretty traditional in the approach to getting coverage.
You're an expert here in cancer drugs and companion diagnostics. And one of the big themes of the ASCO meeting now, 2 years running, maybe 3 years running, is this woeful statistics on patients who have a diagnosed condition not getting the proper biomarker testing for their condition. In some cases, it's only 40% or 50%. And here's where people really have a job to do, to talk about the importance of this testing. It's an incredibly good investment if you're going to save wasted money on drugs, identifying people properly, and I don't think we see nearly as much of that as we probably should.
I mean, it's the pharma companies that are going to have to pay for that.
We understand they're going to have to, and if anything, they are backing off a little bit, as you know, with the Genentech news last week.
I think what the problem is that for these drug launches, they don't have an ROI tied to a lot of these tactics.
Right, right.
And it's hard to calculate how all these activities or tactics roll up to a specific target test rate for those patients in a certain amount of time.
That's true.
Globally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of the disconnect of what is the formula. And it's,
right.
I mean, we've seen with Keytruda is probably the most successful example.
For
but
sure.
How much was spent on
that test.
But I think a large part of it was because of the portfolio. It's not just one indication. It's many indications for PD-L1 testing. So it was worth the investment to go in, and spend it for, literally dozens of
For sure. But if anyone here runs a surgical pathology service or an oncology service, you know that one of the things you have to fight is to say, let's not immediately put the patient on Keytruda. Let's do some biomarker testing and get the appropriate cancer drug for the patient. And that's become a very big issue in lots of labs.
And which PD-L1 test?
And then, and as we know, the PD-L1 test is not easy to figure out.
Yeah. Right, we're just, any final question? We have three, 4 minutes left.
Bob, curious, what do you see as far as ideal open rates? Digital advertising, what's the goal? The open rate versus click rate?
Well, the open rate should run between about 25% and 35%. It can be as high as 40. It can be as low as 15 and still be successful. What I like to show in our deployment reports is the percentage delivered, not the percentage that's wasted. I have a pie chart I can share with people who do e-directs with us, and what I want is a very small sliver of non-delivered or dropped, or God forbid, please take me off your email list, which thank God we don't have very much of it at all, that we have to deal with. For me, that's the standard. The click-through rate is what we used to call the old bingo card. You know, that it all depends on the quality of the offer, the need, the spirit of the moment, you know, for someone to click through. And people are getting fatigued working at their computers. So doctors and others in healthcare, they're there for hours, you know, and that's
sorry,
a factor.
I thought you were pointing
out. No, please, tell me
so
more.
Those open rates that you're talking about, though, are those for your publication, like newsletters?
No, it could be just an e-direct that we send out on behalf of one of our companies. It's like a direct mail, except it's email. And then the people open that up.
Got it.
And then they may or may not click on it once they've seen it.
Sure. Okay.
In the same way that you think of a print ad, you open a magazine, you see an ad, okay, that's a pretty interesting thing, or it's not interesting at all, and I go buy it.
Yeah.
And then if you're really interested in the product, you might call the 800 number in the ad. Well, the click through is kind of a quasi 800 number use. If you will. It's going to be much, much lower.
Right. I'm just assuming that you have a more engaged audience.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a very high.
It's even higher than.
Well, it all works together.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Right.
It all works together.
The industry average I've seen, like, for B2B marketing is, like, an 18%.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
That's why I was clear.
Consumer even lower.
Well, you have to... You have to consider the source, okay? So we have a very active group.
That was the point.
They know the CAP has a great presence in the minds of laboratorians, thank God.
Yes.
It's been a huge advantage for us over the years. It's part of why we deliberately built our publications the way we did. And so those open rates come through.
Right, and I think it speaks to what Bob's saying speaks to what Lynn was saying, you know, having a neutral source, using neutral sources more than just direct sources. We sort of have to do that more now because they're tired of hearing from us directly all the time. Thank you very much for your time today. We really appreciate it. And if you have other questions or follow-up, we'll be here the rest of the meeting and tomorrow and so forth. So thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.